You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Hey, it's Thursday. It's the Two Shot Podcast, and this is episode 122 with David Mameni. Do you want some good news? I thought you could do with some good news. Now, whenever we record, I'm saying this whenever, I'd say 90% of the time, we've always been welcomed with open arms to Maison Bateau on Greek Street, which is a lovely little cake and coffee shop. You know it. If you know Soho, you know it. It's an institution in Soho. The most fantastic cakes, great service, and they've always let us record down there in their basement. And not once did they accept any money from us at all. They've always done it for free for years since we started, and we've always been very grateful to Tanya and Michelle and everybody who works at Maison Bateau. Now, due to the current state of the world, obviously they've had to close the doors, and they were worried that they may have to remain closed. That is until the very kind and generous donations of maybe some of you. A lot of people have been digging deep and throwing what they can. And I just found out yesterday that they've surpassed their goal, which means that they can afford to stay afloat and pay their staff for another 2 months, which is brilliant news. And that's all down to people being so generous, because they've always been generous with a lot of other people. So it's just about time that we can pay that back. So massive, massive congratulations to Maison Bateau. I know a lot of businesses are struggling. I'm not going to get into it. It's not that type of podcast, is it? You come here because you want a bit of escapism with other people and other people's stories. And that's what we're going to try and do week in, week out. What I've been doing for the past week, I've recorded a few episodes remotely. One was with video, and the other few have just been with audio. And I'll be honest with you, I've got to get my head around this. I'm finding this very difficult. It's just a new way of recording. Obviously, I've been so used to having the human being in front of me and looking into their eyes, and looking and reading their body language. So with doing this, it's slightly alien. So give me a bit of time to get used to it. And I'm sure for you to get used to it, but hopefully you won't be getting used to it for that much longer. I mean, who knows? Let's just see how we go. But as long as we just stay indoors and do that and do some cooking and listen to lots of podcasts and watch lots of films, then we'll see how we get on, shall we? So, a long, long time ago, it feels anyway, myself and Griff met David in London. Big shout out to Native Bankside for giving us a space to record in London, because speaking of Maison Bateau, we couldn't record there because it was such a lovely day and it was super busy, and they're right next door to where the Harry Potter play is on, and it was matinee, and we just didn't want to take up the space when they could have had paying customers, obviously. But the very generous folk at Native Bankside gave us a hotel room and we recorded in there, and we met up with David, and it was towards the end of the day and we got down to it. Now, David is a fantastic actor. You'll know him from things like Dead Pixels on Channel 4 and Sliced. But also, he founded this incredible initiative that I've been behind from the world go, and I'm sure a lot of you know about it. It's called Open Door. And if you don't know a lot about it, mate, sounding like one of those old school DJs locked up. If you don't know anything about Open Door, then we're going to get into it. But first, we're going to get into talking about David Mameni. This is episode 122 of the Two Shot Podcast, and I shall see you at the end. Enjoy.
Hi, I'm your inner dream monologue, and you're fast asleep, so I'll be quick. Great job using the Colgate Optic White Overnight Teeth Whitening Pen before bed. When used as directed, it gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 7 days. So while I fly and talk to animals, you're removing teeth stains with ease. Sweet dreams. And when you wake up, keep on living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
David, I'm not wrong in saying this, but we've been in discussions about you coming on this, I think, since the very, very early days of the podcast.
I remember, yeah.
Why has it taken us so long? And it has taken us so long, hasn't it? And not for want to try in, but it's just about organising dates, isn't it?
Scheduling. And
and you've been very, very busy doing all sorts of things.
It's like having two full-time jobs, that's what it's like. So sometimes time is hard.
Yeah.
But I think you asked me once, and I think I was away, I was working, and then...
We've been trying to plan it for a few times, but a lot of the time that comes back, and it's, because we've got auditions... I think tomorrow you've got auditions, haven't you?
Tomorrow I've got to run a workshop.
Yeah, I've got a workshop tomorrow.
Mm.
So I was trying to think about where we should start this, and because I really want to get into the Open Door Natter, because I think it's vital and I think it's really, really interesting, and also for people who don't know about it. So I think we should wait to get to that.
Yeah.
What do you feel about that? Is that cool? So I think we should start at the beginning, and I think we should talk about growing up. So where are we growing up?
So we're growing up in Northwest London.
Whereabouts? Northwest?
Willesden, Kensal Rise.
Right, okay. I'm only nearly laughing because what people can't see, because it's a podcast.
Just try to fit that question in my mouth.
David just tried to fit, was it a Dorito?
It was one of the French fries.
It was a French fry.
It's a mixed bag of crisps.
Sorry. Walkers are not sponsors of this podcast.
I wasn't going to mention their name.
But we said French fries, so, you know, it only takes two and two. Surely if Walkers want to come on board, I mean, surely everybody's picked like a Gary Lineker by now. They must be. They need to. It's 2020.
It's not been about in a while. I've not seen those adverts in a while.
That's true.
This is it.
Walkers, climb on. Anyway, we're not talking about Walkers. We're talking... That's a gorgeous tag. There we go. We've got that. Willesden.
I lived in... My, road and the two roads around it were surrounded by Kensal Rise, Willesden and Queen's Park.
Right.
Which, at the time, were all quite rough areas. I think people think Queen's Park was always nice, and it has got the park, and there are nice bits, but, at one point, it was more... it felt more dangerous or rough when you come out of the station than Willesden did. But
it's not like
protected.
That now, is it?
No, it's,
I mean, it's
all
very... Yeah.
Patisseries, delicatessens. The same old story about London. And I remember, like, what? Cause look, I've got quite on a quite long road, and the other end of the road was quite rough.
Yeah.
And the kids were different on each side. So the kids that would play the street on my side, like, you know, didn't bother each other. And the ones up there would, like, try and throw stuff up the road. You were sort of scared to go down into the road. And then Kensal Rye is, like... And now it's, like, obviously seen as one of, like, the really nicest areas, poshest areas of London.
But yeah.
It was really rough. Like, there was shootings once a month. You'd always see a thing about, like, have you seen this, you know, the murder of this, or did anyone see anything? And I remember when we were, like, 17... So, yeah, go to 17 when you start going to parties and stuff. And you're like, we've run out of booze, let's go. And the only thing open was like this 7-Eleven in Kensal Rise. But you had to go as a big group because you're worried about just getting mugged or someone taking your stuff or whatever. So we just, you sort of just like run it down.
Did it become the norm? Was it just, oh, well, that's just what I grew up with and that's just what it is?
Yeah, it really became the norm. And my primary school was fine. My primary school was quite nice. And everyone that was in my year went to Hampstead School.
Okay.
And that was the, you know, primary school, like there's a name, like we have to get to this. Everyone's like going to that school. You know,
yeah.
And for whatever, me and this other guy weren't in the catchment. So like everyone went to Hampstead and we went to Quinton Kynaston.
Where's that?
QK, which is in Swiss Cottage.
And well, still not too shabby, is it? Swiss Cottage.
What was
it like back then? Sorry.
No, I think Swiss Cottage wasn't... Well, yeah, because you're surrounded by, obviously, St. John's Wood. I mean, our school was technically in St. John's Wood.
Right.
And opposite our school was an American school, which was like a private, you know, international students and all that kind of stuff. But Quinton Kynaston, QK, was like, I didn't know at the time when I was a kid. My mum thought it was still better than Queen's Park Community School. And it was like...
What year are we talking here? Just so I can get an anchor.
98? I don't know.
Okay.
Is that... That works about if I graduated like 2014, yeah, 98. That sounds about right. So yeah, end of the 90s, and she sounds so old, doesn't it? End of the 90s.
It really doesn't. Not to me.
And it was rough. Like, I think the year before we came, there was no barriers or gates around the school.
Yeah.
And so people would just come in and do what they want and walk their dog or whatever in the playground. And then they put the gates up. And there was a terrible case about that head teacher being stabbed. I don't know if you remember.
I do remember
Lawrence,
that, actually.
And later found out that was a guy from previous years, obviously years before I came, had gone down and done that to another school. And so the school that I went to was rough. It was really bad. It was notoriously bad. And I had a terrible time, if I'm honest. Like,
did you?
Yeah, man. Bullying was strong. And it wasn't a bullying where, like... same kids come beat you up and take your money over. It wasn't that kind of thing. It was like names and everyone was trying to outdo each other, be that physically or...
So it was more psychologically for you emotionally?
Yeah, 100%. It was super hard. And I think because I was quite like open and like, oh, I want to make friends. And actually it was kind of, people wanted to make friends, but it was about... Well, you know how schools work. It's about taking people down.
And looking for people's weaknesses.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know why, like, I remember I'm a bit camp, but school back then, I think, you know, what you heard in the Penguin all the time was like gay, 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 gay. And it was used in a derogatory way, and it was used in a way that was supposed to be harmful and negative. And which I'd like to think schools, you know, school I worked in a few years ago, you know, people are opening out and it's kind of changed a bit. But back then, it was a tool that people would use to sort of emasculate what they thought was, you know, emasculating someone. And and it made you question, it made you start to question that and go, oh, like maybe I am because everyone thinks I am, or you think everyone, but it's a couple of people, do you know what I mean? And it's stupid stuff where because you can't play football, because I had these weird like penguin feet and I can't control the ball. I was good at all the other sports, but no one played any of the other sports in a concrete playground. You don't play rugby or it's a bit of basketball. I was quite good at that. But it's just stupid things like that. Or because I didn't like fighting, or I used to cry. Like I used to be really like sensitive. I was hypersensitive. So those things used to sort like super affect me. It was a massive part of my growing up. I had a terrible time. So that thing you said at the beginning, which prompted me to say it, was that idea that like that was my world. I thought the world was like kiddlehood, and that was the world.
Right. Okay. How did that impact your? Well, let's start with how did it impact your home life?
Home life was kind of a safer place. I mean, there's always stuff at home, isn't it, for everyone? And I probably won't go into that too much.
But well, sometimes, you know. Sometimes not.
And different levels, you know. There's always, like, you know, something. But I think definitely, like, that was a more stable thing. You know, I was lucky to have a mum and a dad and sisters where I didn't live in an area that I was surrounded by those areas, but my home life didn't have the aggression or the... I wasn't in the fear that I might have had at school.
Right, okay.
Do you know what I mean? And it was, I was scared. Like, it was, and it's not mad to think young people are scared to, like, oh yeah, it's not, you know, I thought about contemplating bringing a knife because they'll walk home or bringing a knife to school because it was a constant threat.
Because of protection?
Yeah, because you're scared, because people did have knives. Or someone would come from another school. I remember the first day, my mum bought me this bag, which was like this massive Adidas bag, which is quite, you know, at least it was Adidas, but it was like it was like what you put like artwork in. It was quite like, I don't know, like a big old rectangle kind of thing that I had.
Yeah.
And I used to put all my books in it. And only like, I think 2 weeks in, my one teacher said, you know, you don't need to bring all the books every day. You only need to the books that you have. You know what I mean? If you don't have science today, don't bring the massive science book.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like weighed down by this. I was like, oh, okay. I'm tall now, but I wasn't that tall back then. I had a growth spurt. And I remember the first day, and there was this kid on the floor, and he was bleeding. He'd been beaten up in sixth form. I was year seven. I could see behind the gates in front of the school. And the Kosovan kids had a fight with the black kids at school.
Right.
And it was like that. It wasn't that it was the gangs, or there weren't even gangs, but it wasn't that the groups were necessarily, it wasn't cause of race or where the people were, but it was that those were the forms of friends and how people, that just, because friendship groups.
Was it about culture or?
Sometimes, because it was a time after, I'm not smart enough to remember the history of sort of like Kosovo War and all that kind of stuff, but you had, our school was so ethnically diverse, and you know, every type of group was there. It wasn't dominated by one specific race. It was a big Middle Eastern, big South Asian, Caribbean, African, like, white was probably the minorities in terms of white English.
Is it still quite like that today? Wealsden Queen's Park, Kensal Rising Area.
Wealsden Queen's Park has changed. I think that school has changed. I mean, year below me was like Talisa. She came for sixth form.
Right.
And she was like really quiet. She seemed nice and nice.
And when you said Talisa, you mean it's so solid crew, Talisa?
N-dubs.
Okay.
N-dubs.
Oh, she's not so
solid? No. So solid is like Ashley Waters, 21 seconds.
I get my N-dubs and my Talisa's all mixed up. Yeah. Oh, that's what I'm talking about. There you go.
Lisa Maffia. Lisa Maffia,
yeah, of course. I'm so hip.
No, I can see that, Mr. Choice of Chris. So school was... Yeah, Swiss Cottage, yeah, again, has improved. And we also... And, like, Jihadi John was in the year below me. Like, he went to our school, like...
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what when I say our school was, it's not like, oh yeah, our school's a bit rough. Like
it was rough.
Yeah. And I remember when that story came out, and I was going into an audition, and I made probably, I don't think it wasn't distasteful, but I just sort of said, you know, Jihadi John, I named a few people that went there, and I said, you know, F Eaton, we've got all the high achievers. And then because that story just broke, I had all the newspapers like try to contact me on social media, and I think I was in like Ealing Studios going for some like, you know, two lines in a massive film, you know, those ones. And then someone from The Sun was like, oh, can we talk? I said, look, I'm just about to get an audition. When I come out, you know, I'll let you know. And as soon as I came out, I'd had a missed call. They'd somehow got my number. Because everyone was trying to find the face of this boy and the name of this boy. And there was a couple of people that were not those sort of tabloid newspapers that I was like more sort of wanted to help. And, one of my friends I've stayed in touch with from school, who sort of talks out about extremism. He's a science teacher now as well, but he often talks about sort of extremism and Muslim extremism and how sort of to sort of soften that, I guess, and sort of mend some things.
What sort of radicalization as well?
Yeah, radicalization, and he tries to sort of tackle that by speaking out about it and stuff like that. And I sort of, he knows a little bit more about that kind of stuff, so I sort of referred him that way. But yeah, like, because I think the Jihadi John thing, everyone said that, yeah, he was this normal, nice kid, and then he went and got, no, but like, he was in fights. I mean, as soon as I saw the picture, I was like, that young man, because of our school, or not. But yeah, there was constant fighting. There was like, you remember Nutmeg Rush? Where like, if I kick the ball between your legs, you get a punch on the arm.
Now, you have to remember that I'm from the north of England and we have different sayings. So if someone, if we're on a bike, right, okay, me and you, David, when we're young, and I'm standing up, but I've got you on the seat, and your legs are dangling, right, but I'm riding the bike, what do you call that?
Oh, it's like, it is called a, what would you call it?
I'd call it a backy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I think they would call it that.
Because I think I'm right in saying this is either on the back or the front. I think it's the back. So I think, and please don't text me in or email in people from the northeast. But I'm pretty sure in sort of in the northeast Newcastle way, they call it a croggy.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yours makes sense.
You know, don't say that. You don't want no, but like there's some logic to it. No, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's simple, isn't it? It's a fucking backy. But yeah. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so nutmeg rush.
Nutmeg. So a nutmeg, I think that is a common football term. I'm not a big football man.
Oh, you're speaking to someone who is so unsporty. But
good. So a fellow unsporty. Yeah. No. So it's when you kick the leg between, you kick the ball between someone's leg. So, you know, a player's about to go to the goal, you're the defender.
And he sort of rushes it past the leg.
Through your legs and I go past you to take the ball.
I.
That's the nutmeg.
Yes.
A rush is, well, like London back then, rush meant like to beat someone up, we rushed him, like we beat him up.
Right.
So nutmeg rush was like, if I get the ball through your leg, you usually get like people, quite, you know, you get a punch in the arm. But my school on nutmeg rush was like...
But you've achieved the nutmeg, so therefore you've still got the ball, so why do you have to get hit?
You rush the nutmeg, the person you've nutmegged.
Oh, so if you get the ball through, then you're able to give him a punch.
Yeah. So if let's break it down a bit more. If I put the ball through your legs, I get to punch you.
Yeah, I'm not liking this game.
No. So imagine playing it with like, there was probably 50 kids playing at one time between year 7 and 9 and everyone just beats them up. Yeah, that was how it worked.
I'm not playing this game.
And it was fun.
Well,
and the games also were like loads of year 7s versus like six formers. And then people just fighting. So that kind of was, that was
the game of choice.
That was school. That was school. That was the school that I brought up in. And I know you're supposed to say, "Oh, it made you," and I'm sure it made me. I was, but I'd rather done without it, I think.
Yeah, me too. Hearing this, but how did all this impact your education?
I was all right at school, but all right at my school isn't like a B. All right at my school is like you're nearer a C. You're just under a C. So I was like a CD kind of guy.
Yeah.
But in sort of the stuff that I was interested in. So when you got to do sort of like the practical side of drama, for example, I might get an A or B.
Right. This is interesting. Was drama on your curriculum?
Yeah,
it was. It was.
Yeah, it was good. That was what was good. And I hadn't really done it before. You do a sort of play in year six, don't you? Year six at primary school or whatever. But I hadn't really done much or anything really. And...
Because, you know, sometimes, especially even more so now, right now, in schools, it's extracurricular.
Yeah. And it's getting cut all the time. Now we've got PE teachers on a rotation teaching that, drama, music and art. Like, it's got to a place like that. There are still loads of schools that still value it, but it's got that bad in some places.
Which I'm sure we'll get onto much more later on.
The politics of it all. But yeah, we did have drama, and for whatever reason, I seemed to make people laugh in it because you improvise, and obviously that was must have been my go-to. And then suddenly people wanted to be in my group, so I was kind of like popular in that one class. And so that became a place.
How did that make you feel?
Yeah, because it's nice to feel that you're good at something.
Yeah.
That's how we often work, isn't it? Like, we end up doing the thing that we think we get, hopefully get some joy, or we think we're quite good at it. That was quite nice, I guess. I guess that was quite good, and that was a place that I could go do it. And then, like, you know, when you did A-level, and we did A-level, was it media? And we had to make a a trailer to a thriller.
Right, okay.
So I got my tutor, geography teacher to be the victim, and he was getting stalked and stuff, and I filmed it around.
What, the teacher was willing to be in it?
Yeah. Like, you know, there were teachers, the teachers, because it was such a challenging school, to work in those schools, or sometimes there's teachers that are literally signing in and, you know, I can't cope with the kids. And
yeah.
Many of teachers, you know, classes would make loads of teachers cry. That was a standard. Like, sometimes that was the game in the class, no learning would be done. Like, there were some classes where it was a joke. Like, I mean, we didn't do any learning. People just threw stuff and just tried to make the teacher cry. That was kind of a thing.
Kids are just horrible, aren't
horrible,
they?
Yeah, horrible, yeah. Horrible bastards. But full of that sort of... And it all just comes from insecurity and sort of sometimes mayhem at home and going... Yeah, just not having the confidence.
It's just factors of so many things.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, you've got really good teachers, and you've got teachers who know how to work with those classes. And the teacher we had, Mr. Umar, who I had for years, was my tutor. He taught geography, and he was super strict. He wasn't like my mate who I said is a science teacher, who was like,
yeah,
he can relate to the kids, but he's also had the discipline. He wasn't like that, but because he had an amount of discipline that was fair and it wasn't erratic, and he always stayed calm, he was able to control that class. And I remember having a really inspirational history teacher in year 7 and 8, and then he went. And often what happens when schools need a redoing, they go into politics a bit, but they get rid of some of the long-term teachers because it's cheaper to have new teachers. And so some of the teachers weren't ready for the classes that were about to be put upon them, basically. But anyway, back to media. The teacher was in the film, and ended up being example work for like EdExcel for like how to do it.
Right.
But all the written work, I was terrible. I mean, I think I ended up getting a C in drama, but my practical stuff was good because I was just rubbish at writing and my handwriting was bad. And
was it because you were rubbish, or you just didn't feel that you wanted to do it?
A bit of both. I'm boring. Why would I study? Like, I don't. You know, it's really hard to revise. I just found it really.
Because obviously that wasn't stimulating you at all.
No, it just isn't. And I think people got suspicions that I might be a bit ADHD, so that might be a thing now, where like I just want to focus on the things that I like doing or that I'm passionate about. And yeah, that's what it was. And I think the Unicorn Theatre, who now are building, they make, you know, theatre for children and young people. They came in and they wanted some young people or children to be in this professional piece they were doing in the West End somewhere. I think it's now Wetherspoons, but it was in some like old church, and that's when I realised.
Isn't every lovely building now it's a Wetherspoons?
It's a Wetherspoons. Yeah, that's true. Some of them are beautiful. Do you know that one in Holloway Road? I think it's called the Coronet.
Didn't that used to be a gorgeous cinema?
It's amazing.
I've never been in, but whenever I go past it, it's like Art Decoy.
Yeah, it's like a TARDIS. Like, yes. It's amazing in there. Like, it's so big.
So sad.
But so sad that it's Wetherspoons. But it's beautiful. What was I saying?
Unicorn Theatre, the Cape Stone School.
And then I got a bit on it, and I remember going, oh, this is like a proper job. Like, this is a...
How old were you now at this point?
I was like year 9 or something, so I was at 13.
Right, okay.
And then some mum from one of the primary school friends, she said, if you're interested in acting, if you like doing that, he should go to this thing called ATS, Artist Theatre School, which Amanda Redman, she ran.
Where's that?
In Ealing.
Right, which is West London.
Yeah, West London. And it wasn't one of them sort of stage schools where you're paying loads of money. It was, I think it was 100 and something for like a term, which, okay, now people can say like access to stuff, but back then that was really cheap. I started doing that. And she ended up being some kind of... I'll go into it later, but she ended up sort of tutoring me to get to drama school, which kind of led to all the stuff we'll talk about later.
Was that a once-a-week thing?
Yeah, once-a-week, every Saturday. And some classes were, why am I here? And some classes were amazing. And sometimes Ray Winston did some masterclass.
But in that life, some classes I go, oh, I don't know what I'm doing this for.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's just what you connect to sometimes, isn't it? But
or what you take from it.
Yeah. And there was I'm now a trustee for a charity called Dream Arts, and that was one as well where they came in and they were doing, I think it was 101 Arabian Nights.
Right.
But it was with young people from, you know, local schools and all the rest of it, and we did the Cockpit Theatre, which is this small theatre on Edgeware Road, where other young people come see it. I remember doing a Romeo and Juliet where I was Paris, and they changed the story. It was a hip-hop musical version.
Right.
You know, inner city London.
Yeah.
And I was Paris. I think I ended up stabbing Romeo. And Juliet lived. So they mixed it up at the end. But I remember they had a character, Rosaline, and and she had like a song in it. She did like Stevie Wonder's Ribbon in the Sky or whatever. And all the young people were like shouting, because her character was like, I think, supposed to be quite promiscuous or whatever. They were shouting like, ho, but all these like derogatory things. And then the director had to stop the show and sort of break it out and say, look, this isn't real. Like, oh, it's good that you're interacting.
Because yeah.
I don't know if you've done any plays or you've ever gone to a play where there's young people in the audience. They believe it.
Well, I was kind of
the
to
best.
Say,
it's kind of the best thing.
I went to see The Beauty Queen of Lunan at the Young Vic, Mark Madonna play. And there was a group in the evening, I think, a lot of young people. And they were shouting out, don't do that. This really, the climatic role of the play. And I'm not going to say what it is because I don't want to spoil it because it's such a fucking amazing play. But something happens and they're shouting, don't do that. Don't. And it's something. Oh, God, it was hilarious. It would turn into a rock concert.
Yeah.
But it was brilliant. I remember speaking to some of the actors who were on stage afterwards and they loved it. They couldn't get enough of it.
Because you usually when you're on stage, you don't know what's... Unless it's a comedy and you get the laughs, you sort of have no idea what people are feeling about it.
Oh, you knew exactly what was going on there. And that's great because you're getting young people into theatre.
Yeah, it's only our theatre culture that teaches us not to sort of interact. And when, I don't know when that happened. But I mean, you know, if you think about back in the day, down the road at the Globe...
Oh, Jesus, yeah, of course.
I think there was some period where we stopped doing that, but... Yeah, I think it's really cool. It means they're engaged and it means they're listening.
Jeez, they'd have been chucking shit at the stage in them days.
Booing the characters. Come yeah. Out. A bit like Panto, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. Where were we with that? Why did we get there?
Well, we're just talking about how little bits of professional jobs.
Doing those things. So, those are all sort of youth art stuff, you know. And then.
And what were you thinking at this point? Were you thinking.
I think that by then I knew I wanted to be an actor.
Oh, really?
Because I used to. I wasn't noticed with like, I used to go to the theatre lots as a kid. I used to stay in and just watch TV. I watched like every show, sitcoms that I didn't know why people were laughing, but I was still like, I'm going to figure this out eventually. A bit like when you start watching Tom and Jerry and you can't read the bits. You know, the bits where the, when you're a little kid and you haven't learned to read properly.
Yeah.
And sometimes they hold the signs up of like, no, danger or no, and you still don't know what it is, but it's like, oh, I'll figure those out.
Or it's a newspaper headline that sort of swirls
around. Yeah. And I'll figure it out. There'll be an age where I do figure it out. And that was it with like stand-up comedy and all that kind of stuff as well. But I used to watch a lot of TV, I think. And I think, so I didn't really understand it. I was like, oh, are people volunteering? You just don't know, do you? Like,
no, of course, you've got no frame of reference, have you?
Yeah. So when that Unicorn Theatre thing happened, I was like, oh, it's a proper job and all those little experiences. And I did, you know, someone was like, oh, you should do National Youth Theatre. So I did that.
Oh, did you?
Doing plays, yeah.
And that's Holloway...
Holloway Road, yeah. Near the Coronet.
Yeah.
Although we never did go there.
You were too young.
Yeah.
And anyway, it wasn't Wetherspoons at that point, I'm sure.
It probably wasn't. It was in the cinema. So I did that. And yeah, like the actors I did the youth theatre with, like, I mean, you're talking about like, I feel like every TV show you're on or you've probably had half of them on this podcast.
Go on, drop them. See who was there. Tell
it
me
was
who was
our
there.
Peers, like Susan Wacoma. I can't think of anyone. Ashley Zangaza. God, there's so many actors. I suddenly can't think of them. Do you know what? As we go, I'll just pop names out.
Just drop them. Yeah, but I'll pick them up.
It was just a really amazing time. So I think the youth fit sort of opened up from doing like two plays a year to like lots of different stuff.
So what was that? Because I never went to National Youth Theatre, but I always kind of looked up to it. But I didn't really know anybody who went. When I remember seeing a poster at school, and I thought, oh, that looks right on my street, but I don't really know who to talk to about it.
Yeah.
And it turns out that somebody had just put the poster up at school, but no one could really
know about it.
Really
yeah.
help or anything. Yeah. And also, it was London, and, you know, it's far away from me. So what was that? Was that a summer thing, or...?
Yeah, some kid at school was just like, I think it was in sixth form, he was like, or GCSE, and he was like, oh, you should do this National Youth Theatre thing. I'm doing it. So I was like, what is it? And yeah, you audition and then you did this like summer course.
Right.
Where like my check bounced and then we had to find the money. But
So you had to pay for it?
Yeah, you got to pay. You had to pay for audition as well. And it's still like that.
Do you know offhand how much it is for a summer National Youth Theatre?
I mean, I don't know how much it is now, but if you're resident and you're staying there, it's definitely over a grand. It's like, I think so, £800 or something like that.
Right, okay.
I don't want to say because I'm not sure and I don't want to say what it is.
What I might do is I might do a little check and find out, and then I can put it in the blurb of this when this episode goes out. Or a link that people can go to find out.
But I remember also auditioning. I'd never done an audition before. Like, not like that. Like, the auditions for those other things were like workshops.
Yeah.
And I had to do two monologues, and it was like a modern and a classical.
Oh, really? So it was like proper...
It was proper. It was like auditioning for drama school. And we were doing Macbeth at school, so I just did that. I did the dagger scene.
Of course.
Just a dagger, which is before me. And the other one was like, monologue, like, where do I find it? I didn't know it had been about for a few years, Google. So I was on Google and I was like, monologues. And it was one about this guy who was trying to sell Coca-Cola to these pregnant women, being like, can we inject this thing into you? We'll give you thousands of pounds. And it's so the kid's like slightly addicted to Coca-Cola.
Right.
Grow up, therefore we'll make more profit. And the guy who, you know, was quite sort of respectable now, his Ed. Oh, damn. But he was the old sort of artistic director. He's passed away now, but he must have seen something because I was making it up. I mean, I was sort of like improvising, and which now you think actually that is good rather than sort of, it's how just we teach them to do, you know, how you should do work where it's like alive and all that kind of stuff. But I was making up bits of Shakespeare. I didn't really understand that you had to like learn it. Do you know what I mean? Because you hadn't at school. You don't really understand that you have to learn it and then work on it. How do you know that?
You didn't know any better. No reference at all.
We had this tennis teacher and he used to be an actor. So I like literally on the morning before I went to him, and he was like, oh, you definitely need to learn it better. I was like, oh, okay. I just didn't know. But somehow I got a place and that was that. And I had a really great summer. But
obviously compared to school, you're going to the National Youth Theatre and you're meeting lots of like-minded people who are wanting the same thing.
Yeah, the non-aggressive, and people from around the country, never heard people from Wales, from the north, like, seen on TV, but it's the first time you've seen other people from all over.
Yeah.
And everyone was super nice and friendly, and I think I did it quite young. I was in the sort of senior group, but I was quite young, and I couldn't afford to stay in the... They have, like, a residence thing, which obviously where, you know, everyone's staying in the same building, so it's really fun.
But just to sleep over for like...
Yeah, because people are from all over the country. So it was like 2 weeks. Three weeks. Back.
Wow.
It was 3 weeks. It was at Guildhall when I did it. And so it was kind of like a... Yeah, it was a beautiful, positive, like brilliant thing.
Did things change within you because of that? Did your mindset change about sort of the possible future and what you
I think
you
it
wanted.
Was a number of the things. I think it was all those things that I've mentioned before together, really. I think I was at a point at that time. And I remember thinking when I was wanting to audition, I wanted to audition for Bristol Old Vic.
Right.
Because it was outside London. And my world at that time was violent. Like, it was horrible. So I thought that the whole of London was like that.
Sure.
That makes sense? Because my only relationship to my surroundings was school and where I, you know, I lived and stuff.
Yeah.
So for me to get out of London and study was a really important thing. I thought that's what I wanted to do. And I remember auditioning. I didn't really know what I was doing. You know what I mean?
So you went to Bristol?
No, I didn't go to Bristol.
You auditioned?
I went to audition and I ended up on the shortlist in the first year and I was at school. And I remember thinking, wow, like, oh, that was quite amazing.
Right.
So then the next year I auditioned. And I think I had a recall at Central that first year as well. But I literally didn't. I mean... I did it all by myself. And then the second... I was waiting on the waiting list. And we were doing a show with ATS, with Amanda's school.
Right.
And she said, look, do you know yet? And I said, no. She goes, look, if you don't get in, I'm going to give you free lessons, basically. So that's what she did. And so I'd go to her house and...
Did she?
Break down the speeches and, hours and hours and hours and hours, of, you know, after over a whole that period of time. And she would...
So she sort of became your mentor?
Yeah, completely, yeah. Completely. And... and then I remember thinking, I mean, because the audition for drama school is harder back then if you're not, middle to upper class white. It was a harder thing, I think, if you...
What do you mean it was harder then?
Because there was less openness to... The barriers were harder that, you know, we've been working on the last 3 years to get rid of, you know, what you're needed and the panels and what's expected of you. Like, I remember going to my Bristol the second time and the guy going, you're not using the iambic. And I'm like, I'm 19. How do I know what that... No one's ever taught the iambic.
Yeah.
This expectation that you know this stuff before you even get there. But also that my voice, you know, I spoke like this, is how I spoke. And so there was an idea that someone like me couldn't be. I remember being at a time like someone my colour as well. I was like, it's kind of me, Adam Deacon, and he's doing Kilt Hood. So I'll be like, doing the different work. I'll be doing the trained version of Van Den Deacon. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I had this thing in my head that, because I was like, oh, there isn't really anyone that's sort of mixed. And
also the thing is, if you're told something like that at such a young age, then you start to believe it.
That
like, oh, well, nobody quite like you, but you have to fit into a certain mould. You have to be this type to achieve any sort of goal going down this path of this business.
Because all the actors were. I mean, all the actors that you go to auditions, everyone around you is of a certain ilk, and I don't know if that's the right word, and then the graduates you were seeing were. And for me, everything I'd done before in the youth had been quite accepting, and managing and Ash Youth Theatre, it wasn't really my class or race or where I was or where I spoke wasn't ever a thing. It wasn't an issue. I always thought it was a good thing, weirdly. Like, I know sometimes I always thought it was I'm different to everyone else. That's quite a good thing. It is, of course, a good thing. But looking back, when I think about, you know, the young people we work with, like, the barriers were more. I mean, the fact that, like, I mean, Amanda, because she went to Bristol, I wasn't getting in anywhere, and she, you know, she was quite a renowned actor, you know, one of their sort of big actors. Yeah. And she phoned them and said, look, what's going on? Like, have you got any feedback? What's going on? They're like, yeah, we just don't think we can train his voice. And that's the kind of level you were dealing with, this idea that, like, you sort of have to have that perfect accent or voice before you even...
Already.
God. So in terms of that, and so when I got in, I didn't get in. So I went to the Bristol recall, because you get automatic recall when you know, if you've already had a final round. Did that, was looking forward, you know, was hopeful, didn't get, got a definite no, not even shortlist that time. And then I didn't get any recalls at any other places. And I was like, I had Drama Centre left, which I didn't really know about. It wasn't one at the time. I think people do know now because of, you know, graduates, but it wasn't one that was in my, Central was down the road from me at the school, but I didn't really know about that one. And I'd already given up. I was like, I had an ex-girlfriend who... gone to Lee Strasberg in New York, and she'd done this like 3-month course. So I was like, do you know what? I'll save up and I'll do that and I'll go there, and then maybe they'll want me when I come back or whatever. And then I did my Drama Centre audition, and someone from Amanda's school, ATS thing, was there. And
what, on the panel?
She was just auditioning as well.
Oh, right, okay.
And I did my audition and I came out, and I remember them asking me, like, and now I know it's Annie, who's head of acting and now tutors for, she's a core teacher at RADA and teaches, you know, it's one of our open door tutors. But she was asking me about, like, what it's like to grow up where I'm from, like, discussion we're having. And I remember going, I was talking so much rubbish, like, because I had this idea of how I needed to present myself and the rest of it. I think in my head I'd already given up. And I went back, came out of the audition. I was like, look, I'm going to go to the rehearsals because I'm not going to get a recall, because they put a list up at Drama Centre in the first round. She's like, no, stay. This girl was like, stay. And I was like, what's the point? Like, it's not happening for me because people like me. And I also remember thinking that Drama Centre was known for like different kind of actors, edgy actors. So I got in my head that I needed to grow a goatee. So I grew this goatee. I just look like a weird sort of half Iranian David Brent. I grew this goatee. Anyway, they came out and I went to the list and my name was on the list. And I was like, oh, okay, I've got a bit of a chance here.
Right.
Did the second round, the head teacher was there. Did that in the third round. I had to tell this joke. They were like, be an animal. And this guy who I knew was like in the second year, he came, spoke to me, and he told me this story about Brando. Do you know this story? That he was at training, where he was training in America. Yeah. And they got him and his classmates to be chickens and go around and be chickens. And then they said, a nuclear bomb has gone off, 5 miles away or whatever. So everyone was like, wah, 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 wah. Everyone's going mad at chickens. And Brando just sort of carried on as he did. And after, they were like, look, why didn't you react? And he was like, well, a chicken's not going to know that a nuclear bomb's gone off. You know, they didn't know it's no different. So I had that in my head. So I was like a chicken in this third final round. And everyone, of course, does like lions and tigers.
Yeah.
Girls and the boys. So I was this chicken, and then you had to turn it into a character. And I was just like, geezer, do you know what I mean? Bobbing my neck a lot.
Yeah.
And I told this joke, which won't be funny, especially on a podcast. It was like, knock, knock. I got someone. I was like, yeah, can I use you? Knock, knock. Who's there interrupting starfish, and then I put my hand on their face, interrupting starfish.
Yeah.
Everyone started laughing.
You got a little laugh in the corner. Come on. Producer Griff sat on the velvet sofa, you see.
That reaches through people's ears.
Yeah.
And laughed. And then I thought, you know, I've got a shot here. And then within two, I did the recall the next week and I was in. when I thought that was absolutely impossibility.
Right.
And I felt like they celebrated the fact that I was different. But still, when I started there, I mean, I didn't realise my class and race until I went there. I'd never questioned it.
Explain more. What do you mean by that?
Well, like, when you grow up, everyone's mixed and you don't think about class because your world is that.
Yeah.
And then when you go into drama school at that time anyway, and what would have been the industry at that time, you realise, oh, like, I'm different. Like, I didn't realise. And people would, just the way that, oh, no one's like me. If you think that 7% went to, 7% of the country went to private school, majority of people in the year went to private school.
Yeah, right.
Which makes makes no sense.
Were you made to feel different there, or was that just a realisation within yourself?
Sometimes by my peers, because sometimes I get quite passionate. You know, I talk with my hands and stuff.
Yeah.
But I would never call myself aggressive. And I remember someone saying, oh, you're getting quite aggressive, which is a lot of the young people we deal with, they get told that. And you're like, no, that's just how they speak to each other. They don't want to they're just saying how they feel.
Yeah.
And they're not angry. No one's going to hate each other.
It's more passion than aggression.
It's just passion. Yeah. It's just, oh, but why are we doing that? Oh, do you think maybe this? And so I remember that being a thing. But also, like, the first thing we ever did was Bernard Shaw, which is completely wordy. And not only dealing with the fact that, like, I wasn't a fantastic reader, it was me, there's an actress called Katie West, and she was from Stockport, and she, like, that's one of the only schools she's always working at the Exchange. And she...
Yeah, that's how I know the name.
Yeah. She's, you know, she's Queen of Theatre. And there was a girl from Burnley, and I mean, there was another guy called Anthony in my year, but the rest, everyone else was of the same ilk. And we had the diverse year.
Right.
You know what I mean? But it was like three people of colour and five working class people, but that was the diverse year, whereas the year below and above were pretty, everyone was. And thinking, like, these young other kids in the class, they knew this world, this sort of, that the world of the Bernard Shaw, whereas we were like, I've got to change my accent, my body. We couldn't just act. We had to change everything. It was double work for us.
Yeah.
And you know, that is the one thing I would say. There wasn't necessarily a race at drama set anyway. It wasn't a race thing. I don't, maybe someone would argue not, but it was class.
Yeah, but you have
class
to go,
was a massive.
You have
thing.
To go from your own personal experience, don't you?
I would say class was a big thing, and it was end up being a class divide because, as often places in the institution, there's favoritism, and the favorites were the people who had their idea of what an actor should look and sound like, you know.
Right.
And I remember sitting in a Wetherspoons in Farringdon.
As any good student would do, David.
When we had a class off,
yeah,
we'd go to Wetherspoons in the morning and we'd get the £1.99 breakfast. When that still existed, I don't know if it still exists.
Griff's £1.99 breakfast still exist?
I think it's £2.99.
There you go. As
thieves.
Not that as much changed over the years. But did you feel supported? When there was some sort of class divide?
I think I was all right, because I think they thought I was reasonably talented. I was always in the middle, so I didn't get done over by parts.
Right.
It's a confidence thing, because you're made to feel like you can't do the work that they're doing. And because the work they're doing is so heavily classical, because you can't reach it straight away, you're sort of made to feel like you need to be like these students. And so if you've got some old-fashioned teachers, which there's always some...
Oh, absolutely.
You've got a voice teacher who basically... I remember sitting in the sort of speech class, and every time I asked a question, she made me feel like, she was like, you need to speak better, basically. So I remember sitting in the class wanting to cry and being like, oh, I can't even use my voice. And which a voice to an actor is so, you're already in this sort of pressured environment. And I felt like I wanted to cry, you know.
And they wanted to fit you in a certain mold.
Well, that it was worse. It was kind of like I wasn't where I needed to be, but I'm here to learn. Because their idea of what an actor needs to look and sound like,
right,
which was,
okay,
at the time, that's what they thought it was. Even though the industry had moved on, it's definitely moved on in the last 7 years, but 10 or 11 years ago, there was still mainly classical work on the rest of it. But it was sort of like, it was that. And I think that became, I remember sitting at Wetherspoons and just two tables, because the favourites had sort of felt like there was a sort of hierarchy. They were the good actors. And
well, they were certainly told. And
they were told, so they thought, that's what I mean.
They were.
And so we were sitting on this other table, and I was like, flipping hell, like, that's mad. Why are we on two different, apart from my friend Lola, who's from a quite well-to-do background and, like, has, you know, a very famous industry dad, but because she was from London, she was chilled, she came with us. And it's not that anyone hated each other. it was just like, it was just this divide.
But do you think the divide was caused by how...
It was caused by staff.
Students were treated from the tutors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Right.
100%. And if, you know, if you've got a young person, if you've got an actor who can't reach that Bernard Shaw straight away, because why would they have ever done that? They've done some youth theatre in Burnley.
And it doesn't come naturally to them.
And it doesn't come naturally to them, and it's work. They'll be judged on the performance at the last thing. So in the head of that tutor is like, oh, these are the good actors. They're not able to reach that thing, without understanding that that student has to do triple the work of those other people. Everyone else just gets to act. But everyone else, but we have to worry about our body, our voice. I was London, so I guess I didn't have to, I didn't have a strong Midlands or Northern accent. I had to, and everything was RP. Everything had to be RP. It wasn't about speaking in your own voice back then. So, so there's people that just literally couldn't do it. If you can't, you've got to stop that student from doing it if they can't do it. I mean, it's mad. Yeah, so
then you work on the strengths that they do have.
Yeah, and you know, when they come out, you, you know, you want to be able to have that skill, but it's if someone's really struggling, I mean, that's the thing. So I guess that led to how, what, you know, my mindset of everything else. But it equally was a, I had the most amazing training, and drama centre back then was, I remember a lot of students gone to like RADA and stuff, and they were like, oh, we should go to drama centre, because they knew the quality of the training at that time.
Yeah.
Was so good.
And it was always, it was quite renowned for its, there was always myths and legends around drama centre.
Because of the old days, trauma centre.
The trauma centre, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And we heard those stories too.
Yeah.
And I remember people going, oh God, it's not like the old days. I'm thinking, old days sound terrible. They sound terrible. And what Annie and Vladimir did, because I know it's, I'm talking about class stuff and it's you know, okay, I've, I guess I've criticised the time there, but what they did do is get rid of all that. It became a place where you, you weren't in fear. No teachers were horrible to you.
Yeah.
If they was, you can go to her and they'd have a word. We had this voice teacher who was a bit, I don't know, I'm going to be bad to him. I won't say his name, then we'll be all right. He was called the Master of Voice. He'd named himself.
Yeah, we can always beep it out. It's fine. What, he gave himself?
I think he was called Master of Voice at the Globe at the time.
Right.
And I think he came in and he'd wear Armani suits and there was some incense playing,
smoking
off.
Away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And again, like, he would talk and he would tell these stories that were actually, he would talk about how, like, he met someone and they turned to a raven in front of him. You're dealing with stuff like that. So he talked about
this is stuff that he believed, or these were stories.
He said it happened. He said it happened to him. So he talked about this story, how he was in,
Griff, get on the Google with this guy. I need to put this in a link.
He now does like help kind of, yeah, that kind of stuff, spiritual help kind of stuff now. I don't think he gets employed by, okay, as a voice teacher. But I remember hearing these stories. There was one where he went, I was in Native America with my Native America. He was in, because later on he uses them, he was in a forest in North America and he was sunbathing already. I'm like, why are you sunbathing in a forest? But we're there and the wind was going and the trees stopped and I heard hooka maka, hooka maka, hooka mama. And this tribe of Native Americans came and they said, you are the, you are the ancestor of a great shaman. And my friend from the Bronx who'd come from America at the time, Tony, was like, that never would have happened. They hate white people. Like, they killed them all. Like, that never would have happened. And the shaman took me. He spoke like this. He took me into the forest. And I saw him turn into a raven in front of me. And he taught me the shaman ways. And I, they then gave me this drug. And you know, like that thing that, that people do, don't they, to get high based for 2 days and it makes you feel like awful.
Ayahuasca.
That's basically what he said. So that I understood, that that could have happened. And he was put into a cave and he was naked in the cave. And he woke up and he was being dragged by a donkey up the mountain. And he woke up and he could speak to the, I could speak to the animals.
Right.
So you're dealing with that. And because these young people are like, oh, this is a massive main school. Like, I got to look up to these people. And people are like that. And me and my mate Tom were like, he was like laughing into his water bottle because we're like, this is actually mad. Eventually we clocked on him because we just never did any voice work. I mean, we did a poem, we'd be like, you need to speak lower. And so you had people just going, look, speaking low all the time. There was never any voice work. And so eventually, which now I think about it makes sense, I was like, they brought this speech teacher in and she was new. And then she, now she's ended up speaking lots of schools. And I don't know if she's even in drama schools anymore because she's so sort of wanted. And she made me feel loads better in my voice. She was like, oh no, like it's fine. It's just muscles. If you do this and this and this, it will get better. And suddenly I was like, oh, like, yeah, it is just a muscle. My diction can get better. And then he wanted to get someone else in her place. So I started this petition and I was like, this is finally, we've got a voiceage that's good. And this has to stop. Like, we've literally not had any voice because at the time the voice wasn't great. And that's what happened. And she stayed and eventually his hours got cut. And then, you know, because everyone after years realised it just wasn't any good. But but I guess, yeah. So I guess even then I was doing things like
so long.
Yeah, it took 2.5 years. We had a voice teacher by the end.
Fucking hell.
I think especially back then, because I think voice, because of the things we were talking about, like voice is such a massive part. And if you're telling someone their voice ain't right, there's something wrong. What the damage that can do is quite heavy. Like, it's quite
huge.
Not letting them speak. And you're going, oh, that's your accent, that's your dialect. Because this RP thing is like a made up, you know, it's not even like an actual real dialect from the real place, but it's this standard thing. But it doesn't mean it's the right thing. If you go to the North, like this idea that, like, you know, we see on TV, we see lawyers and they've always generally got an RP accent. Be like, if you go to the North, there's a lot of lawyers with Northern accents. That's just the standard. I Wales.
I played a lawyer in my time, yeah. David. I'll tell you.
You've broken the mold.
I was very North.
You've broken the mold. But like, that's, you know, that idea of it. So yeah, it had that stuff. It had the class, but the training was amazing. And I think I felt very lucky to have gone there. And although I had this idea of what I wanted to go to Bristol and the rest of it, I was so glad that someone like me went to Drama Centre, which was so thorough and it was about like acting. You learn about acting as opposed to sword fighting.
You know, you wanted to go to Bristol because you were heavily influenced because Amanda went to Bristol. So it's a very
And I wanted to leave London because I thought the whole world was going to...
There were so many factors in that. Now, obviously, I don't touch on work that much when I talk to actors anyway, for all sorts of reasons, because, right. You know, it's kind of dull and I want to get to know the person. I mean, not just for me. I don't want it to be dull for actors coming and going, oh, we talk about this job. And, you know, it becomes part and parcel of the job anyway. But what I'm so interested about and stuff that I don't know about and I want to educate myself a bit more is the very start, the germ of the idea of Open Door.
Yeah.
Where did it come from and when did it start?
So,
and for people who are listening now who don't know what Open Door is, me and David are going to be discussing this now. Yeah. So you will, you'll start to learn more about what
so
it is.
So I still start at the beginning.
I think so. Yeah. So, I think it's a really good place to start with it.
Yeah. So,
and I'm saying this from a selfish point of view because I don't know and I really want to know.
It's good. So, I worked with young people since I was about 17 in Dream Arts. They taught young people to teach young people, which I think is really good. You're getting facilitators from the area to work with people because actually in participation, the average, like most people are sort of white middle-class females. That's just general participation work as a whole. So I think it was really good that they got people from the thing to teach young people and set them up. And that's probably what led to it. And so I started teaching little ones. And then after time I was doing more facilitating and I was I did stuff in National Youth Theatre and peer stuff, and which included some work in some young offenders and all that. And then I became associate, and when I graduated I was sitting on panels, but I'd sort of taught and facilitated for a long time. And when I graduated I also worked in a school part-time. It was a school that was doing amazing work but a very deprived area in South London, sort of very like white working class and African and East Asian. That was sort of the mix of the school.
Okay.
In Kidbrook, and I'd travel like 2.5 hours to get there.
Right. Were you still in Wales then at this point?
I was still in Wales. Yeah. I had to travel right across. And what I kept seeing with all these things is that young people didn't know how to do it, how to get into it. They didn't really know that drama school was a thing. There just seemed to be this massive gap between with knowledge. So when I remember doing National Youth Music Choir or something like that. I applied for it when I was younger, and the teacher at school was like, in music, I was like 15 or whatever, and was like, you should apply for this. And I said, okay, what songs are you doing? She was like, Wonderwall and something else. So I go into the audition, rehearse with a teacher, and again, I'm in this audition room going, no one looks like me, no one sounds like me. And I heard this warming up on the side, you know, which I know is like scales and stuff, but I didn't know. So I'm like, oh,
yeah.
I was like, oh, what's all this? And then they were like, David, you can warm up now. And I was like, I don't know how to warm up. So I just sung my song really quietly in the corner. And then this person came in and I went in and did my songs and I didn't get a place. Fine. The next show I went again, she said, you should go again. And I went. And when I got there this time, they said, oh, you're the Wonderwall boy. So I've been a joke.
They remembered you.
They remembered it because I've been a joke. Because I'd been something to laugh at. I'd been something to be like, oh, he came and did Wonderwall, which was like, you know, a ballady version. I didn't have a guitar out. But it's like, it's that idea that like you're expecting these people to understand. Like if there are these rules, you need to tell them. If there's specific songs you want to do. But the fact that I'd sort of been talked about and laughed about. So when I used to do auditions for National Youth Theatre, always run over, and I especially always run over because I thought it was pointless that these people are coming in and not telling them what they need to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was like this 14-year-old mixed race boy who came in and did Professor Snape from Harry Potter and just had some lines saying, you know, be quiet, Hermione, be quiet, Ron. And so I took my time to be like, hey, like find a speech like this, something your age, something you connect to, think about this. So they get something from the audition. So when they come back next year, They're coming with something.
Yeah.
Because no one's telling them that they need to be truthful.
Well, if people aren't given the knowledge, what are they supposed to do? Yeah.
And the other reason I felt there were a lot of things that I felt were quite exploitatory of young people, paying hundreds of pounds for two nights a week or a night a week. And there's like this pyramid sort of scheme. So it's kind of like beginner two, beginner three, intermediate two, intermediate three, professional, semi-professional, blah, blah, agency at the top. So, you know, I'm obviously trying not to name a certain thing, but it's about money. It's not about nurturing any talent. It's about this idea that I'm going to get you a job. You can be in the agency and all that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of things like, you know, those sort of stage schooly things, which we can set up any day. We don't have to have, we can just set up a branch.
Well, I've spoken about this in the past that anybody can set all this
up. Yeah.
And I remember you might have seen maybe a year or 18 months ago, somebody had posted on social media that they were doing a weekend course of, you know, acting for the screen with this some sort of renowned actor. And I had to look him up, never heard of him at all.
This is it. They call it a masterclass.
They call it a masterclass. And they're charging upwards of like £80 per day.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is...
They're money-making.
Well, we're exploiting young people. That's a lot of fucking money.
Especially if your organisation is deemed at a certain target group.
Well, it is a target group.
And you're telling
that
it's accessible and actually it ain't. And often what happened, I saw a lot, that drama schools, people would say, drama schools are too expensive, this is what you should do instead.
Right.
And so I saw the sort of pushing down of drama schools and their reputation.
Yeah.
And that's what they do, because they call their things drama schools. And you're like, that's not what it is. Your acting course. And if they say, oh, we come do some acting classes, beautiful, that's fine. And being transparent about it is great. But to call it a drama school in the same way where people are doing, you know, all this, you know, some of the best teachers in the country every day, hours, you know, every week, you can't compare that to. And to say that you're a drama school, I just think there's something about it that's not quite... genuine, and it's quite,
well,
quite
it isn't, and you're not, you're certainly not accredited.
You're not accredited. Who's crediting it?
Yeah.
So, you know, we deal with a lot of people that come from some of these organisations that come with horror stories. Like, I've been in this for 4 years, and actually then I was told to pay more, and I have to wear a T-shirt. I have to wear the T-shirt, the branding, I'm not allowed in the class. People that have they're in the agencies, and they go, well, you're not working at the moment, so you have to go back to the classes. Essentially, you're not making money for us in the agency, so you have to go and pay for classes. I mean, it's that bad.
It's like a fucking sweatshop.
It's just bad.
Yeah.
And then, so the exploitation, the fact that young people didn't know how to get into it. And the other thing was also that I'd sort of done bits of tutoring. Sometimes I'd done it for free and sometimes depending on the income of the person. And there were these twins, Mari and Leah, and they were helping out with the National Youth Theatre auditions. They'd already members and they were sort of helping. They see how I was working with the people coming to audition. And they were like, hey, look, I'm auditioning with drama school. Will you have a look? So I got talking to them and they told me how their father passed away and their mother wasn't really coping financially. So they were helping out. And I said, look, why don't I help you over that period of time? And so I helped them with their speeches and all that kind of stuff. And one got into Guildhall, one got into RADA.
Wow.
And then since graduated, one's done a show at the Bridge and the other one, they both were in this, you know, they were making a spin-off of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think the pilot's gone through, but they were in the pilot. So if it'd gone through, so I was like, how can I do that on a bigger scale? So first I was like, oh, let me just go back to old drama centre and ask for 8 auditions. But the first time I spoke to it was my mate, Amelia Clark, who's in my years now a patron. And I started talking, I've got this idea. And I kept seeing Twitter, like everyone just going, everything's wrong. These people need to do this. And I'm just like, no one's doing anything. Everyone's just moaning about it, which is, you know, the often state of social media.
Yeah.
And I just realized like, oh, maybe people don't know, because what I've actually come up with isn't that innovative. Like it isn't some new idea. When I set it up, as we'll talk about in a sec, everyone was like, oh, I can't believe this didn't exist before. And so I remember speaking to Amelia and I was like, I've got this idea. And I was like, would you be a patron? She was like, yeah. But the thing didn't really exist. So I went to drummers, I got eight. Went to speak to Amanda. And she said, look, I think you should start small. I was like, okay, I'll start small. So I went for eight. And then through a castorette called Nadira Sukuma.
Right.
She heard about it. So I had a meeting with her and she knew with Royal Welsh. So I got eight from there. And then I went with Rada and they offered 30. So I went back to all the others. I was like, look, they're offering 30. Can you give me 30 auditions, free auditions? Because free auditions didn't really exist. Now there's lots of fee waivers and stuff. But three years ago, that wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
And so once I had those three, I was like, everyone's going to seem really mean if they don't give it. You know, it's politics. Like the whole thing.
Hopefully people will follow suit. That's the thing.
My life is very political these days. And you have to sort of just, if you're dealing with big institutions and people and sometimes ego. And,
but also you're fighting for change.
Yeah. But you have to, you can't, my tactics tend to not just like kick the door down. My tactics more and sort of, cuss people on Twitter and social media. I tend to do it behind the scenes. I tend to try and get people a bit more positive about it. And
but you go in with such a sort of calm and savvy approach. I mean, do you remember when a couple of years ago when we did that panel at the BFI and there was a lot of anger from certain people coming in the audience, and it's like, don't walk into the room with all that anger because you've already lost. People are not going to respect you and your voice means nothing because you've gone a bull in a china shop.
It's fine to have the anger, of course, that passion, all that stuff, but if you can sort of channel it in a way that's effective.
Exactly, it's how it's channeled.
Because I need to talk about what it is still, but like it's taken a massive chunk. My life changed. Like without sounding too like a martyr, like it's sacrifice. Like my life is changed. But if you really care, I think you should do something about it.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. So I put my money where my mouth is, and I did this film and I did this TV job, and I was like, right. I had 300. I thought I'll use £300 of it, and I'll get someone. Ruth, who now works full time for us, who was an actress, become an actress again, producer, and worked a lot with young people. And I was like, I'm going to give you this and we're going to apply for Arts Council money. But before that, I tried to give it to the old Vic. They don't know. I tried to give it to them. But Alex Ferris, who's our trustee, who was head of participation then, I said, look, I've got this idea. I haven't got time to do it because the acting was going all right. I said, I haven't got time to do it. I think, but because they did all of it, New Voices and all that stuff, I thought it was a good home for it. He said, like, I think you should do it. I think it will happen quicker. Have you thought about Arts Council money? I thought Arts Council money was just for plays, and he said no. So we went for the lowest of the low, went for that, for the 15 grand, the sort of the max of that sort of lower thing. And the first year was just me and a broken computer, and I had someone working part-time 3 days a week, had a bit of money, and I moved back home because I thought I can't afford to, I won't be able to have another job. So
I need to balance that out.
Yeah, so I had to move home because I can't do all three things. I can't bring home, £900 for rent or whatever. So, we got this Arts Council money. I got all the schools involved, any theatres I'd ever worked at. I just said, hey, look, if you've got space free when you're not using it, could things happen here? And some people were so positive, but people admitted after, like, yeah, I thought you were dreaming it wasn't going to happen. I remember someone saying to me, why are you trying to change the world? I was like, I've got some people into drama school, so I reckon I can just get a few more people in. That's all it was to me.
Fucking hell, that's negative.
Yeah, so it put me off for a bit. And that same person texted me once it launched and it sort of made a bit of a fuss. They launched off. I was like, if there's anything you can do, I was like, well, you should have been a bit more positive when I was first going to do it.
Yeah.
But so I went to drama school, got the theatres involved, and that's where the space, that's where the work would happen. And then what else? The patrons, I got a few more patrons and stuff, and asked Amanda, and there was Amelia and Woody Harrison, which everyone's a bit confused by because he's an American movie star. But I did this film called Lost in London, which was this live film, and
with Peter Ferdinando.
Yeah. And as we were shooting it, it was getting streamed to cinemas. So we had to practice like a play. So, and the space that sort of Woody allowed, it, we all got on. It was just a really an amazing experience. And so I just remember going, I remember talking to him about it. And then my working class mind, which is one of the biggest barriers, goes, oh no, like don't ask people for things. And I remember just going to Ruth, I was like, I just WhatsApp him. I was like, Woody, you know that thing that I told you about? Would you just like, would you be a patron? You don't have to do much, maybe like send a tweet or whatever. And I'm going to ask him to do more now, but like, yeah. That's it. And he was like, yeah, okay, cool, dude. Sounds good. And suddenly, you know, suddenly that's how it happened. So I think people are a bit confused by that. And so when it launched, it kind of went a bit mad. I remember launching it and going, oh, what happens now? And it kind of just hit off on Twitter. And it could have been because got all the drama schools, all those big theatres, the patrons. But I think it was the idea itself.
Yeah.
And the fact that everyone was like, why hasn't this happened before? Yeah. I thought this already existed. Because it's just mad to think that it didn't happen. So people paid £2,000. Like, people paid so much money. It was just about outside London after trains and stuff. You know, only £2,000. People just couldn't get even the door. And I remember when I... It's an open door. And I remember when I set it up, I was like, I've got to make sure I have, you know, ethnic minorities representation. But I knew it had to be about talent. I don't want to do any positive discrimination or tick boxes, because I think just it undermines the talent of the young people.
But also the fact that every young person should have a chance to be educated.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the door should be open.
Yeah, 100%.
The bottom line is that.
100%. And I think that what we end up in is that 2/3 of the people that applied were ethnic minorities, which is surprising to me. But because all we've been told is that they don't exist. These actors don't exist. You know, we need to encourage more people. It's like what people have said about the Oscars, right? Like, we need more female directors. And that woman was like, there's female directors, just got to give them jobs.
They're there.
Exactly. So that's what happened. And same with the tutors. I just got all the people I ever wanted to, you know, all the people I respected and wanted to work with. And, you know, people like Roy is now like, Roy Alexander's like, now the artist exchange. Yeah. And he's still doing stuff for us. Someone from Sheffield who goes there for tutoring. People that I thought were good at acting and were just nice would know how to sort of nurture that talent.
And also people with clout.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I was smart. I know. I mean, who else would give me space? But I know having those theatres would help. I know having those patrons would help. I know all that. I also knew that that would encourage young people to sign up, because it sounds like a fancy thing.
Yeah.
And I just sort of learned from all the things that I'd ever been involved with in an organisation. I was like, what are the good bits? What are the bits that need improving? So originally I was just going to tutor 8. And then United Agents, who I'm represented by, my agents heard about it, sort of sent out the line, and they pledged a certain amount of money for 3 years, which meant I was able to tutor 30. Because I realised actually no one cares about the 8. They care about all the 30 that were going to do it.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I'm going to have to tutor all of them, like, find the time to do it. And so that's what happened. And
but how did you find the time? Because you were doing this by yourself.
Oh, I didn't sleep. I didn't sleep, like, I was working 8 hours a day, like, if that's possible. Like, it was, I get home, it's, you know, 8 o'clock or whatever. I've probably got some lines to learn for an audition, because I just come the night before. And I've got all these emails and things to send, because I knew it had to be of quality. I had that first year had to bang. It had to work to the best it had. And I didn't want to let anyone down who'd put so much free stuff that people give us.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to let those young people down, and I needed it to work. And I'd be like, all right, well, I'm up till 2 a.m. And that's what happened. I got up, and people knew me then. And that first year, like, if you think I speak fast now, my mind was just because you're just constantly trying to solve problems at that level and make things work. You know, it's not exaggeration. It was just me and a broken computer and Marshall on 3 days a week, who did way too much. And I was £400 a month or whatever. So acting suffered, like, you preparation, you know, I've got a meeting with you and I've got to tutor a young person, but you give me the audition for tomorrow. Well, I can't not do that.
Yeah.
So sometimes the preparation was bad and I started to worry about it. But I think what was amazing, my agents were so supportive of it. And, you know, like, you're not supposed to say, like, hey, look, can they see me Thursday instead? You know, you're not. But that's what it is, and that's what it still is. You know, I'm like, look, yes, but is that possible?
Yeah, but you're prioritising what's important.
Yeah.
You know, and this is...
And now I'm trying to find the balance again.
Changed your life.
Yeah, now I'm trying to find the balance again. And I think it did take its toll. I didn't have a social life.
Did it ever become too much?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, so what did you do to change things then?
I sort of just, the second year when we were going to go, I said, if we don't get the money we do to have someone else full time,
yeah,
I'm not doing it. We need to pause it for a year. Because right. And we went ambitious straight away. We were like, East Midlands. Because when we launched, there was people that were critical. Like, why is it in London? You're like, it's just me, man. Like, I'm not an organisation. Like, if you want to set up in I don't know, Derby, set up in Derby. Like, I, you do it. I'll help you. I'll give you our arts thing. Because that's the thing about the Twitter thing. It's like, my intention is always to go out. But I don't know one there yet. I need this to work here.
You need to. I remember this distinctly because people go, "Well, why is it just in London?" But it's like, well, we need to get this model completely sound first before we take it anywhere else.
I don't know no one anywhere else yet.
Yeah,
I know these good tutors. I know the theatres, but also I live here.
Yeah,
but you know, people are ready to criticize before they've actually done any research in it. But I try to balance it out. I don't have fights on Twitter. I try to be like, hey, cool, well, this is what we're doing. And if you, I'm happy to help you with an application if you
hopefully
are.
One day.
And they were, hopefully one day. And but when we did the first show in, should I say what it is?
Yeah.
So what they do, each young person that first year got a free audition at RADA, Lambda, Guildhall, Drama Centre, Royal Welsh. Now we've added Royal Scotland, and Drama Centre is in a bit of turmoil at the moment, so there is no Drama Centre this year. And they get one-on-one tutoring with the people I mentioned, Steph O'Driscoll, Ryan Alexander, like just really amazing people, myself at the time, on the Shakespeare, on the moderns and all that kind of stuff. They get a series of workshops every 2 weeks, working with moving directors like Polly Bennett and people at the top of their game. Yeah. Again, it's just friends like Polly Bennett. I was a national theatre in a play with her. Do you know what I mean? It's just favours and friends. And, you know, we were paying them, but very little. And in that first year anyway, and they go to the theatre for free. So they saw plays, you know, Donmar, Royal Court, all that kind of stuff. They all just gave free tickets. So they went to see free shows.
Oh.
And where they do the work is in those buildings. So they get used to being in those buildings. That idea that they don't belong in there, or like, these are bigger than me.
Yeah.
RADA gave us free space in the first year in Central. So they're already in those drama schools as well working. And so when it comes to it, it's less scary. And they also, there's a hardship fund. If they can't get to sessions or whatever, we can help out. Now, sometimes we pay for lunch. If it's a full day and they actually don't even have that much money, they can't afford the books or whatever, the plays, we can do that for them. And what else did they get? They get a buddy each, a person from industry that perhaps a fully similar background who's gone to drama school, to just someone else to speak to. And that's actually really hard. It was actually really hard to find working class actors who had gone to drama school that work, which kind of says some stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The talent kind of finds other ways of coming out.
Yeah.
Because it couldn't quite get through the door. And I was like, if I'm lucky, I'll get one or two in, because, you know, it's 3,000-4,000 people applying for, and some schools it's 6,000 for, you know, 28 places, 30 places. And what we ended up with over 300 recalls, 86 final rounds and 35 offers. Which kind of like,
it is
actually mad. And I think that, so places like Guildhall, which at the time they would have admitted it was quite white middle class, had been for a while, 9 of them had an offer. So a third of the year was made up just from this one scheme of offers.
Wow.
And so now in the first two, you know, I think at the moment there's like 8 people at RADA between the 2 years. There's like 12 at Royal Welsh. It's like 6 at Lambda. There's a ton at Guildhall. Yeah, someone's described it. It might have changed the landscape a bit.
I think it really has, definitely.
Well, and I think just and just the conversation about access.
Are you starting to see a change? And I'm not necessarily saying because of what you've done, but also in a way I kind of am.
Yeah, it's really hard to quantify or say the impact it's had if the schools have made changes themselves. But I know a lot of the changes had come. I used to be a bit shy about saying that, but I'm not anymore. Like, a lot of it has come from that. So RADA and Lambda now have, obviously Sarah's changed since that audition fee, but 25, you know, anyone under the income of 25,000 has a free audition. There's now, there's also travel bursaries and things like that.
Brilliant.
Talking about the panel, changing the panel was one of the biggest stuff. You know, it's the first time they've ever had 30 young people give unbiased feedback. You know, they're not worried about, oh, I better not say anything bad in the feedback form because they might not take me, about the schools. So sort of talking about how one school, for example, a lot of the auditionees found it quite hostile. your panel. Yeah. It wasn't a space where they can go and perform. And if you think about it, it's kind of mad. Like, if you, in any workplace, have feel like you can't, everyone hates you and it's a bit hostile, you don't do good work. You don't feel valued and you don't do good work.
Of course you don't. It's ridiculous.
And if you're about a young person who's, you know, got an overnight train from Scotland all the way down, a coach, and they're there for 10 minutes. And
already under so much pressure on that journey.
And they've had one audition, two auditions, because all they can afford. So the pressure on that audition. And they're knackered because they've been on that overnight coach and then they're treated badly. How are they going to do good work?
Exactly.
It's about creating space. So we start questioning about who are on these panels, because if you've got someone who's only done the RSE 50 years ago, perhaps their idea of what a woman looks and sounds like is different, what an actor should look or sound like is different. And I just think if they haven't never worked with young people, never worked with young actors, so either members of staff or they work with young actors regularly, or they are regular working people in the industry, I'm not sure what their place on the panel is. And so it's sort of bringing those questions into place.
That's
and
so interesting.
What is the diversity in its truest form, not just about race, but in all the different aspects of class, is going on with those panels. And I think class is the thing that's always been missed out. I think a lot of actors have talked out about it. James McAvoy, people like, you know, all that kind of thing. But I think Open Door, I would say that sort of made that conversation a little bit bolder without saying it. We say low income because of what it is. And in terms of it, you have to have a low income. But obviously we can measure class in lots of different ways.
Absolutely.
But I don't think class was actually at the top of the thing. And now you've seen the Arts Council change the social, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And how do we quantify class and all the rest of it. So I would say that that's one of the things. I think the conversation about class has happened, access, about making drama schools were in a place where they were becoming irrelevant. You know, people were sick of the what they were seeing at the showcases, whether it's not the talent wasn't there necessarily, it's not anything bad on the students were coming out, but there was a lack of different type of actors coming out, the type of plays they were doing.
It was an access issue as well.
Which is the biggest point.
Exactly.
So when the big chat about, you know, after Act for Change and all that stuff that started the conversation, I was like, and it's not like these actors don't exist. Of course they did. But to be doing the level of work that and the range of work you want them to be doing, well, we need to start from the bottom because they've, all these actors have been sort of repressed and oppressed for a long time. So let's make a generation of actors and
let's let them know that it is accessible.
It is accessible. And so those kinds of talk about how do we teach and what are we... Access the biggest one, panels, regional auditions, how do they travel there? Do we need four rounds in one place on four different days? Like, that's four train fares. Even administratively, isn't it easier to make sure two rounds are on one day? I see you, hour later, going to the other panel. It's surely cost effective. But all it was is that these things hadn't been looked at because it hadn't really been an issue. We get the talent coming through, what we want. And at that time, I felt that drama schools were starting to seem irrelevant. And I think now that people have got a bit more excited about them again, or that it is a possibility. You know, we talked to a lot of school teachers, even you know, in the last 2 days, I've been doing these school teachers at National Theatre who come up and take workshops. And we were doing stuff about sort of drama schools and monologues and how to work with young actors. And they would talk about the fears they have about the mental health of these young people or the stress they're under, or like, oh God, they're even going to take the young people that I work with. And it's about convincing those youth theatres as well that these are places for them, that they're not going to come out and with an RP accent. Actually, now drama schools are, people are celebrating the accent they have and all the rest of it and reassuring them, because there had been years of neglect. There had been years of where this stuff hadn't happened. And then the industry as well going, I think personally, if the drama schools become irrelevant and go, unless you're from London, really, it's super hard. Here's a place, I want to be an actor, I don't know much, I can go train and there's a bit of a showcase at the end. Because, you know, if Shane Meadows didn't happen to be cast in This Is England at that time, if Skins weren't doing open auditions at that time, there's whole generations of working class actors, especially we talk about the East Mids, you know, if it wasn't for TV Workshop, like, you wouldn't see them.
Absolutely.
And the organisation that will come from that afterwards. But you're talking about a massive lack of just bundles of young people and young actors that we just don't get to see who are brilliant. So what we see as good acting as well, and what is the industry that we're actually trying to make these actors for? Do we need two lessons of period dance a week? Why? 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 Yeah. Why do we? why do we do that? We'll probably learn it on set if I have to do it. Or that much stage, you know, fighting. Most people in action films are probably never went to drama school anyway. Yeah, you get someone who's going to take up to a punch.
Sometimes you think, oh, well, it's just because it's always been the way.
Mm.
Doesn't
that's
mean,
it.
Doesn't mean that it has to continue to be the way.
Yeah. And a lot of time, like, it's more because the drama schools were quite inward looking and insular.
Yeah.
They're really busy. There's a lot going on. You know, how much do the teachers go to the theatre? And have they, you know, even the industry, we've been in it in the last 7 years, has changed drastically. Still, when I came out and graduated, there was still a lot of classical work and all the rest of it, and it was done in a certain way and certain people were doing it, you know.
Yeah.
There were definitely white cast, there were definitely, you know what I mean? But it moved quick. Like, we've changed a lot in the last 7 years.
Yeah.
There weren't even female artistic directors. Like, that didn't exist. Like, that's wild, right? Like,
it's crazy to think like that.
And most of them were white males from Oxford and Cambridge. That was just a standard thing for any artistic director. Yeah. So it's changed so drastically. Of course, there's more to go, but it has.
Exactly.
For us to live both times, I was at the beginning of it, it has. And I think that all that happened is they didn't quite catch on that. They didn't see the work that was happening. And there are some schools that have and always have, like, I won't never say anything that hasn't, but Royal Welsh, you know, there's a guy called Dave Bond who's retiring. He's been the head of acting there for 25 years and he's raised that school up, you know. It's one of the top schools at the moment. And because they have been creating actors that are working actors that are relevant. And, you know, every time I went for a meeting and I'm trying to convince someone that drama school is still a good idea and all that kind of stuff. And I go, well, look at Royal Welsh. And they're like, oh yeah, I know, yeah. And when I go into castings and people want to talk about it in castings, what I'm up to and all the rest of it. And they're like, oh yeah, Dave Bond. We know Dave Bond. Because he understood that there has to be a connection with the industry. It's not a separate thing. You have to keep in touch and know what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's not about networking. It's about going, well, hang on, what's going on? How are we creating it? What is the work we're doing for the time that we're in? What's relevant?
It's like, I remember in my second year at drama school, and also very, very set tutors who were there.
Did you go to drama school?
Yeah, they were in the building, right? And then we had outside directors come in who were working in the industry today.
Mm.
And, well, everything changed. Because I went, well, wait a minute. You're giving me a completely fresh perspective and you're working, you know, you've got your finger on the pulse because you're doing it.
Yeah.
You're directing or you're acting or you're out there. And you're not in this cocoon.
Yeah.
So you're not following the footsteps of what it has always been, what it shall always be.
Yeah.
It's completely different.
Well, how do we better our practice? How do I still want to learn more?
Exactly.
And I think what is really positive, just even, we had a Q&A with part of the process. They have like just graduated students or
yeah.
third years of each drama school come. And two of them were open door people in their second year. And I was like, I remember talking to them going, you know, things are kind of changing, but they weren't. And a little bit, people were talking about it. And last year I was like, okay, we're kind of in like a changeable time. And this year I'm like, oh no, you guys are in a transitional time. But I remember talking about the first year going, you guys are the first wind. Like, you guys are part of this change.
Yeah.
Without making them, not in a sort of big-headed way or so, but like, you guys are part of it. You're not going into perfect things. And I think what's really special is that, and Sarah Frankham sort of backed this up because we were on some Q&A together. Sarah Frankham used to run the exchanges now,
yeah.
head of Lambda. And these are the guys, because there's a confidence to them where they perhaps didn't feel how we felt when we started drama school. It's like, I don't deserve to be here. Or like, oh, maybe I'm the one that's wrong and everyone else is right. That they're the ones going, hey, I'm not sure about this. Can we talk about this? And why is this happening? And doing it in a non-shouty way,
non-aggressive
way of going, hey, like, why? And can we talk about this?
Yeah.
And well, I think that's what's really beautiful about it a little bit.
Non-confrontational.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've got to have conflict. We do get angry and all that rest of it, but there has to be a balance and there has to be something about, I think everything's so polarised. And I'm not sure, which you could say about the country and all the rest and the politics of it, but it's so polarised and I just think it's much easier to maybe put it like this.
Go on.
Open Door happened and it was a positive thing that involved everyone. But its existence highlights the problem and made people go, okay, shit, we need to sort some stuff out. But I didn't need to be aggressive. I didn't need to, aggressive is the wrong word. I didn't need to bring something down to do that. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm in meetings with people and going, this is, we need to change this and all the rest of it. But I guess my route was, which is why it's sometimes unquantifiable. I keep saying, and there's definitely a better word. It's hard to put down perhaps the impact we've had in the change part of things that have been going on, because my logic was, if I'm trying to encourage people to go to drama school, because I think if we flood the people with drama school who don't usually go, the change is going to happen.
Yeah.
Which is happening. If I am then trying to bring down these places, the young people, it's going to continue the cycle where people think it's not for them. So I do everything behind the scenes, and sometimes it's really receptive and relationships change with schools, and sometimes it's easy and sometimes it isn't. And when I need to be, I'll push. I think I've only got angry twice. I've had to be like, that's not on. But I think there's a way of doing it that's like, hey, like, okay, this is happening. Let me show you why this needs to happen.
Yeah.
Getting the drama schools on side, so it's less, because they've been defensive for years, because, you know, every newspaper's attacking them, people attacking them. And I hope I've made it clear, of course, everything's that need to change drastically. But there are people within those institutions that are doing that, and things have changed the last couple of years. But if we can get them on side and go, hey, let me show you, let me introduce you to these people who can show you that, the work you're doing, this works great, but this needs to change. If I can get the industry to go, maybe drama schools are the right place to go. Look, these things are changing. It's going to take some time. If you get young people going, it ain't perfect, but you guys are part of that change. The map things can work together. I don't know. The polarization of everything is quite, I think, demonstrative, and it doesn't quite, it runs out. Because if you just try and bring everything down all the time, eventually no one's going to listen when you do say. I feel like there hasn't really been a thing that I've been super critical of. So I think when I am super critical of some, I hope that someone might go, oh, if he's a bit peed off about it, it must be real bad.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of saving my ammo up a bit. Well, David, that's what I feel about a bit.
Just please carry on doing what you're doing, because I think it's incredible. And you know I've always been supportive of,
definitely, of what you do.
And I think change is the way. And it's absolutely brilliant what you're doing.
Thank you
so much for coming on talking
Thanks
about
for
it.
Having really, me.
Oh, mate. Always welcome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man.
And another episode is done. Thank you so much for downloading and subscribing. Massive thank you to David for giving us his time. And that was, we recorded that at the end of a very long day for both of us. So, I'm always grateful when people just give their time and we don't have to rush. So it was great. Well, should we just, I suppose we'll just do it all again next Thursday, shall we? Okay, well, let's do that. Thanks so much for all your messages. Keep them coming in, and your emails and the support on patreon.com/twoshotpod. I know times are difficult, but you're ever so generous to keep this thing going. And you know what? Don't worry. If you can't afford to support us financially, then when you're on your phone calls or on your Zooms or on your house parties, mention the Two Shot Podcast to a few other people. Let's keep the community growing. And until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been Producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. You take care and stay safe. I shall see you next week. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.